Welcome, everyone, to this discussion co-sponsored by the Journal Dialogue and the UVA Mormon Studies Program. I'm Lori Maffley Kipp, and I hold the Richard L. Bushman Chair in Mormon Studies at the University of Virginia. I want to start by thanking all those who have made this gathering possible. Many hands have been involved in it. Emily Jensen from Dialogue, who you might have met outside, has provided tremendous administrative and logistical support. The LDS Council at UVA, especially Mike Schill, who arranged for us to use this lovely Darden school space, and Jolene Bodley and Steve Bradford, who have been involved in multiple ways, arranging, organizing, and making sure things run smoothly. Thanks, too, to Chris Kimball and Mark Kriego for their tech support up there. It's time we began. The date was 1973, when Lester E. Bush concluded his groundbreaking Dialogue article on race in the Mormon faith with that phrase, "It's time we began." 5 years later, one part of his call to re-examine the historical origins of the temple ban on those of African descent was realized when the church leadership announced the lifting of that ban, opening the way for members of all races to partake in the temple ceremonies. That was indeed an important beginning. But that momentous occasion was only the first step. As valuable as it is to celebrate that achievement nearly 50 years ago, it is even more important to continue to work towards the full realization of the notion that all are alike unto God. Pain still persists after the wound has been bandaged, and scars linger once an injury has healed. This is where the harder work begins for those who have an investment in the health and vitality of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its members. It is challenging to recognize that steps forward on issues of race entail a direct reckoning with an uncomfortable past. It's tempting to dismiss the voices that continue to feel excluded or marginalized within the community of saints, and to recognize that there are still injuries, large and small, that continue to be inflicted. Ending the racial ban did not end the challenges regarding race. So the question today becomes how to move forward from there. The writer John Green provides some valuable wisdom in this regard. He quoted the famous line by the poet Robert Frost that, quote, "the only way out is through," unquote. The only way out is through. But he added to it, this is John Green, "and the only good way through is together. Even when circumstances separate us, in fact, especially when they do, the way through is together." So this discussion today is premised on the idea that the LDS Church, while it has suffered wounds from a legacy of racial discrimination, as have many churches, also contains the seeds of its own recovery and its commitment to community, to talking things through, to hearing others testify, and to bearing one another's pain in order to find forward. This is where we must begin. Now, I'm honored to be led in this discussion by four very distinguished writers who have thought deeply about these issues. Our format today is as follows. We will begin by hearing from two of our panelists, followed by questions and discussions of the issues they're going to raise for us. At about 4:10, we will take a very brief break of 5 minutes, plan accordingly, and then resume at 4:15 to hear a bit about ongoing initiatives at Dialogue and UVA. At approximately 4:25, we'll begin the second half of our presentation from panelists, followed again by more time for questions and discussions. So we'll wrap it up at about 5:30. So I'm going to introduce our first two panelists, who you'll hear from after me. Paul Reeve is professor of history and Simmons Chair of Mormon Studies at the University of Utah. He is author of Let's Talk About Race and Priesthood, published by Deseret Book, and I believe there are copies of it right outside if you want to pick one up, and project manager and general editor of Century of Black Mormons, a digital history database designed to identify all known people of Black African ancestry baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints between 1830 and 1930. Alice Faulkner Birch was born to Cleo and Elwanda Faulkner and raised in Oxnard, California. She is the Director of Research and Content and a main researcher for the Sema Aditi African American Heritage and Culture Foundation, Utah's first and only Black history organization, which focuses on research, preservation, exhibit creation, and presentations on Utah's Black history. So first, Paul.
Okay, I'm just going to share just a few slides to kind of walk you through my experiences with the issue at hand. So over 50 years since Lester Bush published his article in Dialogue. And where are we today? I'm going to frame my conversation just with a couple of big picture ideas of where at least some of the leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are at. When Elder Stephen Snow was a Latter-day Saint church historian, he has said, "My view is that being open about our history solves a whole lot more problems than it creates. It's a philosophy I observe in my own scholarship." We have the current president of the faith. When he was president in the first presidency, articulated to Latter-day Saints that they needed to do better at helping to root out racism. How do we root out racism if we're unwilling to examine its roots amongst Latter-day Saints? And President Russell M. Nelson articulated the notion that human beings are held accountable to God according to their actions, not according to the color of their skin. And yet the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for roughly 130 years did the exact opposite. So how do you root out racism if you're not willing to confront the historical roots of it? I had an experience in 2010 in my congregation in Utah when I was advisor to the Deacons Quorum. I write about it in the Let's Talk About Race and Priesthood book. The lesson manual said the topic for the lesson is the attributes of God. And one of the attributes in the lesson manual was that God is no respecter of persons. I was trying to help these 12 and 13-year-old boys understand the implications of that. And one of those young men in my class in 2010 in Bountiful, Utah, raised his hand and said, "If God is no respecter of persons, then why did he curse Black people with black skin?" That's 2010. That's a 12-year-old boy. Going silent does not solve the problem. That's being perpetuated to the next generation, in other words. And what I continue to hear amongst Latter-day Saints is an effort to continue to justify and explain away the racial restrictions rather than doing the work of rooting out racism and actually owning the racial past so that Latter-day Saints can stand in places of empathy. And what I included in the Let's Talk About Race book were some of those justifications I continue to hear in the 21st century. So the racial restrictions are gone for almost 50 years. And yet the justifications continue to exist. And these are the ways that Latter-day Saints seemed to justify and try to explain away rather than actually rooting out. We don't know. We don't know where the racial restrictions came from. This was the official Come Follow Me manual in 2025 for Declaration 2. And that's a direct picture of the manual. "We don't know why priesthood ordination and temple ordinances were not available to church members of African descent for a time." The people on this panel have written books about why. And to simply try to dismiss it with "we don't know" is not doing the work of rooting out racism. Brigham Young said he knew. And he said he knew very forcefully. There's his speech on the 5th of February, 1852. "If there never was a prophet or apostle of Jesus Christ spoken before, I tell you, this people that are commonly called Negroes are the children of Cain. I know they are. I know they cannot bear rule in the priesthood." How do we continue to claim we don't know when Brigham Young said he knew? Another justification I continue to hear. In the New Testament, Jesus spread the gospel in stages, first to Jews, then to Gentiles, as parallel to first to people of Euro-American ancestry, then to people of Black African ancestry. Simply no justification for this. In this last dispensation, there was no divinely appointed timeline for spreading the good news of the restoration. The Lord commanded Joseph Smith 5 times that the gospel was to be taken unto every creature. And early Latter-day Saints took that seriously. They baptized enslaved people as well as free Black people. Unto every creature is the message of the restoration. There is no spreading the gospel in stages. It's just another justification to explain away rather than do the work of rooting it out. Tribe of Levi. God has always discriminated in distributing priesthood authority. Look at the tribe of Levi in the Old Testament. It's another justification I continue to hear. And this is what I write in the Let's Talk About book. "The tribe of Levi welcomed the other tribes into the tabernacle. The racial restrictions kept people of Black African ancestry out of the temple." These are not parallel. The tribe of Levi welcomed the other tribes into the tabernacle so that they could perform the rituals as articulated in the Old Testament. The racial restrictions barred people of Black African ancestry from temple. And ordaining Black men to the priesthood would have brought down the church. So who are we thinking is the church? If we're using this as a justification, we're thinking it's a white church and ignoring the fact that the first Black person to join the faith was 1830 in Kirtland, Ohio, and there have been Black Latter-day Saints ever since. So you're saying, if you use this as a justification, that it would have destroyed a white church. Would have destroyed a white church. And what I articulate in the book is Latter-day Saints love to quote Joseph Smith's standard of truth. "No unhallowed hand could stop the work from moving forth." That's my paraphrase. Should we really believe that no unhallowed hand can stop the work from progressing and yet treating Black people equally would have? Once again, these are justifications I continue to hear in the 21st century. "Everyone was racist back then. They didn't know any better," is the last one. And I think it's important to understand, right, Orson Pratt was arguing against Brigham Young in 1852. He was a product of the same 19th century cultural context. And he was advocating that Black men should be allowed to vote in 1852 Utah Territory. And Brigham Young responds with, "We just as well give mules the right to vote as Negroes and Indians," in the same speech where he articulates the racial restriction. Both products of the 19th century context. Joseph Smith, a product of the 19th century, sanctioned the ordination of Black men to the priesthood and articulated in 1840 an open racial vision for the temple at Nauvoo that was going to be constructed the following spring. So it's just false to say everyone was racist back then. They didn't know any better. Orson Pratt, Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon are articulating open racial priesthood and temples in the 19th century, and they're a product of the same cultural context. So those are the things that I continue to see operating amongst Latter-day Saints in the 21st century justifying the racial restrictions rather than doing the work that it takes to root them out. And a part of that effort is to recognize that if a black person and a white person in the 20th century received the same Temple Recommend interview before 1978, the white person is admitted and the black person is denied. Frida Lucretia McGee Ballou is one example. She was baptized in 1909 outside of Tylertown, Mississippi, and she waits 69 years before she's admitted into the temple 1 month following the June 1978 revelation. If you're denying a black person and admitting a white person who can answer those questions the same, that's called racism. That's called racism. So that's what I mean when I say, rooting it out requires grappling with what it looked like amongst Latter-day Saints. Thank you.
It's really unfair to have me follow Paul, but I feel sorrier for them. So I've divided mine up into 3 points that I'm going to talk about. First, I'll present my point, and then I will present my whys onto that point. Point number one, leaders can be more aware of who they are selecting to bring into general authority leadership roles by specifically seeking out a variety of peoples. This is not racist. Why? Currently, Elder Peter Johnson is the only general authority of the African diaspora who is African American. Black American, meaning their lineage goes back to the early days of this country. Helvecchio Martins is Brazilian, Joseph W. Citati is Kenyan, and Edward Dube is Zimbabwean. This same pattern has followed with women leaders. Why? This is what affirmative action is, using affirmative action as a tool that is then accompanied by confirmation from the Holy Spirit that the best person has been chosen at the time is an application of the scripture to not be commanded in all things, but to seek to do good and to be anxiously engaged in a good cause. Doctrine and Covenants 58:27. Certainly being inclusive within the church, even in the selection of leaders, is being anxiously engaged in a good cause. Why? Representation matters. Ignoring African Americans in favor of Africans galvanizes the feelings that we do not matter to the leaders because they like our cousins better. Africans and African Americans recognize we are culturally, emotionally, and spiritually different. Our needs are different, and one side of the African diaspora cannot and does not speak to the needs of the other. Contrary to popular belief, not all people of African descent are the same. Why? Intentional selection of leaders is what Jesus did, with an intentional emphasis on diversity, variety, and divergence. Peter was a fisherman, a common worker, no one of high importance and not known. Matthew was a tax collector, someone well known by the public, though disliked by them as well. Simon the Zealot was an anti-Roman freedom fighter. Bartholomew, or Nathaniel, was, as Jesus himself described him in John 1:47, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile. Paul was a big-time sinner and persecutor of Christians before his conversion to the Christ. Number two, have mandatory racial training for all leaders at every level. Why? This training will teach leaders what racism is, that it is real, and what it looks like on a ward level, stake level, and overall church level. Since most European Americans, Europeans, and Africans have no experience with racism, such training is crucial for leaders to understand what non-white European Americans experience within the church. Example one, ward level. Being told, I do not belong. Example number two, stake level. My hand not being shaken while all those around me are. Example number three, overall church level. Lack of representation. Where in general leadership is the African American woman raised in the projects by poor parents who watched Pastor Frederick Price each Sunday to study the Bible, danced with Soul Train, and screamed over Elvis? Where among the current apostles is the African American man who was raised in a non-member home, who found his way to the church during his first marriage because he thought the church could help him be a good dad and have a good marriage, whose first marriage ended in divorce, then married a second time too hastily, who asked God for guidance to marry the right woman for him and married a third time, a man filled with wisdom, understanding, and insight gained from personal life experience. Unless they've changed it, and I've not been paying attention, divorced men are not allowed to hold leadership positions. Why? Talk is cheap until followed by action. People will say anything, but we do what we mean. And point number three, support African American members of the U.S. as much as they support with resources, finances, etc., those African Americans who are not members of the church, and as much as they support members on the African continent and Africans living in the U.S. Why? There has been selectivity by ethnicity. This selectivity has excluded African Americans of the U.S. in favor of other black people. This has led to large numbers of black Americans leaving the church because it is a way of telling us that we are not wanted, not welcomed, and not acceptable. Why? It appears to be the easiest path for the church leaders to ignore real needs because it is too hard. It also points to the idea that black Americans, especially in Utah, have access to resources that African Americans and Africans outside Utah and the U.S. do not. This attitude shows that it is easy to ignore our needs. My conclusion. In John 13:34, Jesus revealed the new commandment on love. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. Paul demonstrated how Jesus loves us in the parable of the body in 1 Corinthians 12, verses 12 through 27. If the foot shall say, because I am not the hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? Those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, upon these we bestow more abundant honor. This parable explains that no one single person or group of people are more important than another in the Church of Christ. It teaches the way to unity within the church. It emphasizes mutual care, individual to individual, and it explains that all spiritual gifts are needed in the community of the church, on the ward level, the stake level, and the general church level.
We have some time for questions, and I'm going to get us started with a few questions for our panelists first. I'm interested in hearing from each of you. Paul, you talked more about the sort of specifics of this historical legacy, and I wonder if, and you sort of alluded to the fact that there are also possibilities to find resources for change in the past. And I wonder if you want to highlight some of those that you found most effective in talking to people about this history. Where are the effective kinds of ways of sort of recovery of the past that can be useful going forward?
Sure. Part of the motivation for the Century of Black Mormons project is simply this. So some of you might be aware, Jacob Rue, a professor of sociology at BYU, did a 2025 study of Black Latter-day Saints in the contemporary Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And one of the findings from his research is simply that knowing about Black Latter-day Saint pioneers can help retention in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. Knowing that Black people had a past in this faith is one of the findings that one way that the past can be helpful in the present. I actually, in case this came up, brought some stats that stuck out to me. So Professor Rue asked me to come to BYU and respond to the study when they presented it for the first time. And I was struck by some of the percentages that his study brought forth versus what we're finding in the Century of Black Mormons database. He's studying live people. I'm studying dead people. It's difficult, right, to match everything up in terms of the research approach, and yet it's really stuck out to me. In 2025, his study showed that 57% of his group were converts and 43% were raised as Latter-day Saints. Then he uses a point of comparison to the Jesse Embry and Alan Cherry sample from 1985 to 1989. In that data set, 87% of those 21 and over were converts. If you include those who were baptized from age 9 to 21, it goes up to 97% were converts. In the Century Black Mormons database, for the first 100 years, we have 63% who were converts and 37% who were raised Latter-day Saints. What this study bears out, in my estimation, is we lost an entire generation. In the Century of Black Mormons database, we have five generations of descendants of Jean Manning James, for example. Mm-hmm. Five generations of Elijah Abel's descendants, five generations who received the priesthood before June 1978. But as these racial restrictions take hold at the beginning of the 20th century, in 1908, Joseph F. Smith says, stop actively seeking people of Black African ancestry for conversion. It becomes known as a white church deliberately. And so one of the ways in which the past can help in the present, I think, is recovering these Black Latter-day Saint pioneers. Not suggesting that, okay, because they joined a faith that still had, racial policies, that somehow everything was hunky-dory. Oh, see, there's a Black Latter-day Saint. There is nothing to worry about. That's not the message. Mm-hmm. Acknowledge the racism, but also acknowledge that these people chose this faith in their life, and that can help produce change in the present.
Mm-hmm. May I comment on that?
Absolutely.
In Jake Rue's study, he also found that the majority, I am so sorry, in Jake Rue's study, he also found that the majority of Black Americans who were baptized into the church, I don't know if it included the ones who were raised as well, but the ones who joined, who converted into the church, remained regardless of learning after being baptized about the racial restriction that existed if they did not learn about it beforehand. And this is also what is found in the Century of Black Mormons. And so when Paul presented the slide that that said from Come Follow Me, that help me remember the language.
Please. We don't know.
Yeah, the we don't know. But though there are those who exercised their faith in God and remained faithful, but some did not, or something like that. I can't remember the verbiage. Something like that. That implies that those people who chose to leave the church because there was nothing for them, because they were not accepted, because they were not treated well, did not have faith in God. There is a difference between faith in God and Jesus Christ and faith in a person or an institution. Those people chose to leave an institution. Who says they ever left God? Of the people that I have studied from Century of Black Mormon, because I only do Utah Black history, but I read some of the others too. The majority of those that I have read about that Paul and his researchers have found for Century Black Mormons remained with God. If they left the church, they still remained with God. That is a difference.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Well, I'll just add, because I brought the numbers, just so in the Century Black Mormons database, we try to, did they die a Latter-day Saint? And one of the ways we try to do this, find an obituary. If their funeral is held in a Latter-day Saint chapel, for example, we count that as remaining a Latter-day Saint. So in the database, 55% are verifiable remaining a Latter-day Saint from their baptism till their death. We have another 27% that we have to mark as unknown. We can't verify whether they're a Latter-day Saint or another faith at the time of death. So that 55% could be as high as 82%. Mm-hmm. And only 18% experience what we call a faith transition. Mm-hmm. And the majority of those, like Alice is pointing out, are joining another Christian denomination. Mm-hmm. Typically Black Baptist, mm-hmm, or AME, African, mm-hmm, Methodist Episcopal, are the two that are emerging as the dominant faith, that if you leave Latter-day Saint as a Black Latter-day Saint, you join AME or Black Baptist. Mm-hmm. Choosing God, mm-hmm, is the point, and the evidence that we are finding bears this out.
Vina, mm-hmm, please.
So my work looked at global Mormonism and focusing on Indian diaspora and also mix of African countries. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing, we don't have data because it's so vast, but from my oral history interviews, from conversations with many of Latter-day Saints who left the tradition, we're seeing very similar, mm-hmm, things happening. Many of them who had come from a Christian background, converted to the church, and also then found out about the restriction, didn't necessarily have a problem with this, because they would tell you, well, we come from a Christian background, we know this history's been there from other Christian denominations, mm-hmm, but it's the racism that lingers, mm-hmm, in present day that makes them want to leave. And oftentimes they do leave and they will go back to their previous religious tradition, mm-hmm, or they will find another Christian denomination. Mm-hmm. And in terms of members who are coming from a Hindu background, they will often go back to Hinduism. Oh. And so we're seeing very similar trend when we talk about racism in the church globally.
Mm-hmm. Let's open it to questions. Yes, first you.
Yeah, I was curious, is this part of the LDS Church, is it restricted to African Americans? Because I know my grandparents were missionaries to Maori people in New Zealand in the 30s, and so I wondered if there was ever any of those same restrictions on Polynesians, or did it affect where missionaries were sent in the early part of the church, or is it very specific to African Americans?
So I'll weigh in on this, and then Matt might want to correct me if I'm wrong or add something. So 1853, first mission to South Africa. So unto every creature is taken seriously, right? Mission to Jamaica, 1853. Brigham Young, is sending missionaries. There's no Professor Christopher Jones at BYU studied that mission to Jamaica. No evidence that they were aware of a racial restriction. It doesn't show up in any of those missionaries' diaries or journals, right? This restriction, it takes time for it in fits and starts to solidify. That's why I suggest it's not firmly in place until the early 20th century under Joseph F. Smith. I think he's as much responsible for its solidification as Brigham Young for its beginning. And they are sending missionaries around the globe in the 1850s. And then they reopen the mission in South Africa at the turn of the 20th century. And they are again baptizing people of Black African ancestry. But there are restrictions by then, and there are no restrictions for other people. So under President David O. McKay, for example, Black Fijians, Filipino Negritos, Australian Aborigines, all ordained to the priesthood. As they sort of refine their understanding, it's if you can trace to African ancestry. DNA wasn't available. Right? And so they are operating under sort of their understanding at the time of what that actually means.
How about like Chinese Americans? There was so much anti-Chinese feeling post the gold rush, but there was actually a pretty large population of China. Did that ever come into place as well? Or was
not in terms of priesthood restriction, certainly racism, yes, but not in terms of ever being denied priesthood restriction. Same for Native Americans. That's seen as a fulfillment of the Book of Mormon promise when Native Americans are given the priesthood and admitted to the temple. And that happens in Nauvoo. And church leaders are celebratory of that. We are fulfilling the promise of the Book of Mormon in their minds, right? So they make a distinction. And it's only people of Black African ancestry that they apply the restrictions to.
Did you want to? Yeah, just one thing to comment. So, I mean, Paul's right. It's just persons who trace their ancestry back to Africa. But there is a racial component dealing with brown people, and that is this notion that everybody was born white, and then certain of God's children were cursed, and that in order to live with God again in the celestial kingdom, they have to have that reversed. And so that's one of those uncomfortable things that the church has struggled with. Some of the apologetic groups that have popped up at my alma mater, BYU, coalesced around that whole idea that that racial curse really is symbolic of your soul. But that's just not borne out by the evidence. The evidence is that Latter-day Saints, much like Protestants, believe that there'd be an actual change in your skin color if you comported in certain ways. And one quick story, 1960, Spencer Kimball was the last church leader to really address this in a general conference. And Chris is back in the quarter there. And I was talking to Chris's dad years ago. So Chris Kimball is Spencer Kimball's grandson, for those of you who don't know. And I was talking to Ed Kimball, who's also the biographer of his father. And I said, tell me about that 1960 sermon. He said, oh, my father wished he could have that one back. I said, I bet. Because they got a plethora of I was going to say emails, but that doesn't work. They got a plethora of letters in 1960 saying, how does this work, Elder Kimball? And, you know, you can't really articulate this because it's just built on a racial fiction. So, but anyway, that's how I think black and brown people were brought in together under this racial umbrella, is through that whiteness theology.
Yes, you're next.
Yes. So you'd mentioned some of general authority statements. Have general authority spoken about racism, especially with any specificity, since November 2024?
I don't remember any.
Why not?
The last one I remember was President Hinckley. When he said in General Conference to deny or treat the priesthood of one man differently because his skin color is different, I can't remember the exact verbiage. It's abominable. It isn't right. It is a sin. Something like that. That's the last one I remember.
Well, then you have President Nelson and and President Oaks.
Right.
Black Lives Matter.
In 2020.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Are you referring to something?
Yeah, I was going to say in response to that, a lot of people stopped talking about racism after November 5th, 2024. Mm.
I mean, they were talking and stuff.
Yes. So that's the presidential election.
Yeah. It seems like in countries that have a British colonial past, the United States, Australia, South Africa, there's a real rigid racial lines. And there's just as much racism in Latin America and whatever, but the racial lines are a lot more fuzzy and blurry. Did the church enforce this racist ban in Latin America? And if they did, how did you determine? Because the racial lines, even though there's just much racism, the racial lines are a lot more fuzzy and blurry in Latin America. So how did they enforce this racist ban there, if they did?
They attempted to. They were in a variety of Latin American countries, an additional lesson. So if you approach a door and you perceive the person has Black African ancestry because of the racial mixing, you move on. Or if you are teaching them, there's an additional lesson that is developed. You asked them, if you come to discover that you have Black African ancestry, will you let your local leaders know? And then in some cases, they released a branch president who found out as branch president that he had African ancestry. But they are definitely baptizing and ordaining and, all of that without knowledge that we know now because of DNA, right? People with much more than one drop, and that was the standard put in place in 1907, one drop, like the nation. Virginia, 1924, adopted a one-drop law to legally define who they could segregate. So, and the LDS Church followed in that trend, right, after Plessy versus Ferguson, and it adopted its one-drop policy in 1907. So, in other words, they attempted to do so in very awkward and racial ways.
Can I just add to that? People became, so when the four generation requirement was given, it actually started, correct me if I'm wrong, okay, in South Africa. And the missionaries were told, the mission president was told, you're to do this with all of the people there because there was so much mixing and they couldn't tell who had one drop and who did not. Those of the lighter skin. And so they had them do a four-generation sheet, and anybody who could trace their genealogy within the four generations to African descent, excuse me, Black African descent, they were then denied the priesthood. They could not advance. They could not go to the temple, etc., etc. Well, people began catching on to what was going on. And even though the church was enforcing this to be done, there were families who found out and they actually left South Africa and moved to Utah because in Utah, nobody could tell. And they soon learned that. And one of the examples is Bessie Ritchie Rogers, Elizabeth Bessie Ritchie Rogers, the daughter of Nelson Holder Ritchie, a Black American man who formerly enslaved, who was married to a white American woman, and so their children were both. Bessie Ritchie Rogers was the first African American woman to enter the temple, the Salt Lake Temple, and to do ordinances there. As well as to work there as an ordinance worker. So there were ways around it. People found ways around it. The church thought they were enforcing it, the leaders did, but it could not be enforced. And the stories that Paul and his researchers are finding through Century of Black Mormons are proving that it could not be enforced. It was impossible to enforce it.
Can I just add one thing? patriarchal blessings were a big one too. So some of the leaders wanted to put the onus of lineage detection or lineage boundaries on patriarchs. You can imagine the apprehension that would have, you know, because what's at stake here, right? Your eternal salvation, your ability to go to the temple. And so some of the patriarchs felt tremendous apprehension, and they refused to give lineage, even though they believed that the person for whom they were delivering the blessing was black and probably they believed that were cursed. But they would declare no lineage, which is a problem, right, in LDS theology, because you're supposed to give lineage. Another thing they struggled with is that they would pronounce the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which are temple blessings, and that's a problem for obvious reasons. This is pre-1978. And then finally, they would then do, you know, the most bold thing. They would tell them that they were the lineage of Cain or Ham or Canaan, which is problematic because a blessing is supposed to give you guidance, make you feel good, and then you walk away being told that your lineage is that of a biblical counterfigure. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, there are letters between the brethren, or among the brethren, about do we put this kind of pressure on patriarchs to discern lineage? And in one instance, one of the apostles, Mark Peterson, he told a patriarch, he said that if you feel inspired to give this person a cursed lineage, then they can't go to the temple, they can't go on a mission. But if you do feel inspired, then that allows them to go on a mission and get married in the temple and all of that. And the patriarch wrote back and he said, you know, I'm feeling a lot of pressure. And, you know, understatement. But that was the challenge they were in by boxing themselves in this corner with the lineage and some of these racial curses.
Thank you. Yeah. That gentleman right there had his hand up. You, who just turned around.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with a statement. I'm going to start with a statement that put everybody at ease, right? Because I'm a brown guy here, and everyone's like, oh, okay, here comes the bomb thrower, and I don't want that to be the case, right? And the statement is, I'm Afro-Latina, Afro-Caribbean. There's a difference, right, as you've mentioned. Afro-Caribbean means that the slaves of my ancestry came from Jamaica and Barbados, and there was a different relationship between the white owners and the enslaved people than in the United States. So that means that my experience with racism is not only fundamentally different than that with an African American, it is extremely unique in the church. And for those who aren't tracking what that means is that black people don't like me just as much as white people. Okay? Right? Because I don't speak like an African-American. My culture, my traditions, everything of the food that I eat, the way my family gathers is very different. It's Caribbean. And I don't know any different. So when I'm a young man, I don't know that I am different. All I know is, geez, everybody hates me unless they're in my physics class, in which they like me, right? So, that being said, I joined the church in 1980, having no idea about the racist thing. Zero. Okay? I just went to, I was a Catholic before, and I joined when I was 11. All right? So I didn't know, and I made a choice. It wasn't my mom made me do it. I did it because my family was doing it. For the first time, missionaries were answering questions for me that Catholic priests couldn't answer. And I was impressed, and I wanted more of that in my life. Now, I say this because, you know, for two big reasons. One, everything you're talking about, I lived through. I am actually struggling with rage right now and struggling with PTSD right now, right? Because I'm listening to this. Everything here is academic, and I appreciate the academic approach. I really, really do. But for me, it's not academic. It's emotional, right? It is. It goes even down towards my children who are mixed race, right? I went to Hawaii to get married. No, that's not true. I was stationed in Hawaii first.
Thank you.
She's not my war bride. No, that's not like that at all. But my point is I knew that I couldn't go to church in the continental United States and find a bride. Right? I knew that. And so I placed myself out of it. My four children, three of them started in the BYU system. Only one graduated, and he looks the most like his mother. So I say all this to, A, reduce everybody's anxiety. If you come and approach me, I am not going to explode. I do appreciate opportunities to speak about this because it's rare that I have an opportunity to actually talk about my experience. I have to be silent about it in church. I have the, now to my question. I mean, I say that, a long preamble, and I do that to hopefully put everybody at ease. When you look at the population of the United States, the population of African Americans in the United States is about 10 to 12%. 14%, all right? The population of African Americans, those who were born in the United States and trace their lineage to probably an enslaved person in the United States, in the church, is between 1 and 3%. And it isn't just because of the history. Because my mom knew about the history. She was born in Panama. She was born in Panama and had actually approached the church because it was close to the church she went to in Panama, a Barbadian church in Panama. And she wanted that for her children and was pushed away. And then when the missionaries came back, it's a long story, I won't tell you. I'll tell you the joke if you want to get up and talk about it later. But she wanted to go. And she chose to go and chose to stay with the church, even regardless of the mission, regardless of the history. But my understanding and my interpretation of why such a small percentage of African Americans do not join the church is because of current racist thoughts that get exposed even during the lessons. To wit would be when I've been in many bishoprics, let me just say it like that, right? And never a bishop, but many bishoprics, that's another story. But a missionary approaching me saying, and they're teaching a young black man, an African American, and they're asking me, they want to know what we think about the priesthood. And my response to them is, they don't want to know what I think. They want to know what you think, mm-hmm. right? If you ask them for me to tell them what I think, I'm going to tell them and you're not going to like it, right? And because it's going to be contrary to what the church says. But you need to go figure that out. I'm not going to help you with this. And that young African-American man walked away. I don't want him to walk away, but I'm also not going to lie to him. Right, nor am I going to stop sustaining my leaders, which puts me in a really freaking weird position. Okay, so I ask, is my instinct wrong there? Is there more there? What does the academic side say to that? And I think you've already kind of said that, but I need to hear again.
Can I tell you what scriptures say to that?
Scripture, and I don't remember where in Doctrine and Covenants that speaks to if a person has the truth and the opportunity to share it, it is your responsibility to share it. And I would say to you, if you hold truth and somebody comes to you and asks you for that, that then becomes your opportunity to share it with that person. Who knows what door is closed when we do not share truth with somebody? Who knows what doors are opened when we do share truth with somebody? I will tell you that one big way that I have acquired truth is by reading these men's books. I've acquired a lot of truth about the past, and the saying that truth shall set you free, I do feel set free because I know what the truth is. I'm no longer held bound by falsehoods, by the precepts of men. When I sit in a class and something erroneous is said, if I feel like it, if I feel that I can handle the ensuing pressure or disagreement or negative energy that will rise up, I will say something. I will say, no, that is incorrect. This is the truth of that. You know, go to whatever. And sometimes I do not. But the truth that I hold has set me free from the falsehoods that are said today, that were said in the past, and that continue to be perpetuated by the young. And that's what really bothers me, is that even today, in 2026, what is it, 171, 172 years later, the young people, young men, young women, are perpetuating the falsehoods.
Could I just hear from the two? I'm sorry to put it this way, but mm-hmm. what he just said was answered by, and I don't know if you noticed, but the two white men looked at the black woman for the answer. Why is that? What do the two white gentlemen, very respectfully, have to say? I've read your books. I know you're good people with good hearts. What do you have to say for that? There is one additional thing that I will add. Last week I happened to be in Seattle, and it so happened the presiding bishop was there and visiting the ward at the same day. And he didn't know me, didn't know my name, didn't know who I was. I was a visitor, and I thought this is my perfect opportunity to go up and ask an anonymous question. And I asked him, quite frankly, why has there been no apology? I understand there's been a change, certainly in 1978 a change was made. Why has there been no apology to African Americans for the racism in the church? And he actually said, I don't know. He did try to point to black people have been called as general authorities by white men, trying to point that out, how good that is. And I couldn't get anything out of him except, he said, you just need to look forward. And I said, so we just need to forgive? And he said, yeah, just look forward. Don't look backward. I couldn't get an answer out of the presiding bishop. Why has there been no apology? And I hate the spot. You're white men, though. What do you have to say to my husband who has said this? You can't go silent. You're authors. What do you have to say?
Yeah, no. Thanks for the follow-up, and thank you for sharing. I looked at Alice because I love and respect Alice, and I knew if she wanted me to go first, she would say, Paul, you take this. I have that kind of relationship with Alice. So I wanted to give her an opportunity. I wasn't, not afraid to speak on this. So thank you for what you shared, right? It really touched me. So this is just my perspective. I'm just some dude who has written on this, but nonetheless, I'm also sort of navigating kind of, the same kind of questions, but from the vantage point of a white male in the 21st century. What you said is absolutely right. If you misrepresent to a person the feelings of betrayal, when they do find out, because they will find out, mm-hmm. are, in my estimation, worse. Yeah. And if people listen to Peter Johnson, he mentioned in his general conference address his own experience with that feeling of betrayal as a missionary when he first found out. We did a conference at the University of Utah where he was on a panel. I would recommend people to watch this. It's available. He developed that much more in depth than his general conference address, and it was painful, his feelings of betrayal. So I have to say, absolutely, you tell the truth and let the people decide, use their agency to make the decision, an informed decision rather than a decision that misshapes the truth. Absolutely is how I would approach it. And I've approached it that way when I've had those opportunities. That's my answer. I just don't think you can somehow shade or, put lipstick on a pig in this situation. You just can't. You have to just own it. That's the whole point of Let's Talk About Race and Priesthood, right? Like, own it. We participated in racism. We experienced a soft form of it. What better people than to stand in places of empathy and move forward in leading out? But to the answer that you got, right, ignore it and move forward, that's not rooting out racism. That's not rooting out racism. That perpetuates the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Vina, did you have something you wanted to?
So as an islander, I get it, because Mauritius is a mix of Indian, African, we call Creole people. Mm-hmm. We're all mixed. And one of the things that members of the church in Mauritius, because we got, the church came after the lifting of the ban on the island officially. And when I was talking to a friend just recently about this from Mauritius, like, what were the conversations around when they learned about the ban? Many of them said they were not surprised, because this is what people who are European, whether they were coming as Catholic priest or Protestant evangelical on the island, this is what was happening. So many people will tell you globally from these different perspectives that they were not surprised. They were not offended about it, in so to speak. But what they do have a problem is the hiding, is not telling the truth. And like a friend said, you know, when we ask, they will say to us, well, we didn't know. The leaders didn't know. They didn't have the revelation. I mean, these are all the examples that Paul gave, the different justifications. And then what my friend said, and this is what I've found out, is, but we all know. We all do. And so even though that they got this reply from leaders, whether they were a bishop or a mission president, that would say, that would oftentimes an American, they would smile and say, but we do know, that was racist. You're just not telling us in our face, mm-hmm. but we do know. And I think this is where church, senior church leaders have kind of missed the ball on this, mm-hmm. is people are not naive. Mm-hmm. And there's an assumption that Latter-day Saints of color are naive, mm-hmm. and that they will just go with it. No, we have had our testimony, and we are coming despite all of the stuff that we know. That's the bigger picture. And so when we hear things like that, is we often smile, and we will just say, okay, not ready to address it, but by the way, we know. You're not fooling us. We're very aware of it.
We have to stop to take a break. I know there are many, many questions out there. Hold your questions. We will have much more time for discussion after our next panel. But right now, we're going to take a very quick 5-minute break and then come back in for more conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.